Have you heard?
It knows that way.
This. Hello, this is. I am a nervous wreck. Okay, no fooling around now. Bye.
A distinguished guest that is known. His name is Dennis Brown, Mississippi, and we are going to discuss a little bit on how he feels about the problem down there and what he thinks we should do about them and how he feels about them.
How old are you?
Well, I'm 15 years old.
Where did you live in the South?
In Vicksburg, Mississippi.
How was it like there?
Well, it's according to what you're talking about, like.
How are the people around there?
Well, I would say maybe if you walk in the streets of Vicksburg, in a town, and the people just kind of know that you're a civil rights worker, they'll probably look at you and stare at you real angry, like, or something like that. And there's some good people, but most of them just seem to be kind of mad with you. And it's good people and also bad people.
Were you ever in jail?
Yes, I was.
How did they treat you there?
Well, at the jail, it wasn't really a jail. At the time, we called it Vietnam because it was a big fairground and was about 600 people there. And they treated us pretty bad. Like, when we went to get our breakfast, we had to wash our trays and garbage cans. And some boys had to stick their hands in scalding water and get it burned. And the cops would come around hitting on you and everything. And we would go to bed about 9 o'clock at night time, and they would beat on seats.
How do you feel about prejudice in your city?
Well, really, you think about it sometimes, but it's really not too much you can do about it. So you don't think about it too much, and maybe if somebody in the town really hates you, you really don't think about it too much because most of the time you'll be doing something else and don't have that on your mind.
How does it feel now to be in New York City?
Well, New York City got a lot of problems to my point of view too, but this is a good school, and mostly I just like going to the school. And I like New York City too, but it still got problems, just like all other cities have.
Do you ever see your parents?
Yes, I see my parents. Anything?
How'd your parents feel about it?
Well, really, my mother and I never talked about it too much, but I know she didn't like it. She would talk about it sometime about different people in the town, but really, don't anyone holler like prejudice in Mississippi, at least Negroes don't.
If you compared New York to your other city, do you like New York a little better?
Well, really, New York is a big city and it's plenty of communities, so I don't know the whole state of New York, but right here in the city, I think it is a plenty of parts of New York City that is way better than Mississippi. So I think on one hand that New York is way better than Mississippi, and in some communities it's not any good as Mississippi is, but that's what I think about it.
In the newspapers, well, did they have any incidents or, you know, about you or about your family or your friends or anything?
Well, in certain newspapers, they had, in July and August, they just came down. Certain newspaper reporters came down and wrote articles on our project. And on October the 4th, 1964, our house was bombed, and that made just about all the newspapers in the nation, just about in the United States at least, New York Times and plenty of others.
Were you happy to see the civil rights workers there when they came to help?
Oh, yes, I was.
Who bombed your house?
Well, really, I couldn't say, but probably, I guess it was probably some Klansmen or something, but really, nothing was done about it. And like they investigated it, the FBI and the police, local police, who they really gave trouble. They just gave us trouble because we had clothes in the houses, different things in the house that was good, and we wanted to get them, and they wouldn't let us go up, and they really didn't do anything about it, just like they did all over Mississippi, bombings all over Mississippi, and they don't do anything about them.
What did the police do about it?
Well, the police didn't do anything, but they say they would carry through a thorough investigation and was in the paper and everything, but they really didn't do anything but cause trouble.
What did they teach you in your school?
Well, in my school, they taught mathematics, social studies, but the social studies was mostly wrote by segregationists, and this textbook was really a segregationist book. And the teachers really didn't want to teach it that way, but some of them had to. And I have to say we had some good teachers, and they tried to teach as good as they could. And I think they did a pretty good job.
In your class, was it a segregationist school class, or was it, you know, normal, but did they still have some prejudice in it?
Well, you see, in my classroom, it was all Negro and was segregated because at the time, this part of the Civil Rights Bill that affects schools, it hadn't went into...
Well...
I say, at the time, this part of the Civil Rights Bill about the integration of schools hadn't went into effect.
How old were you when you left from down there?
Well, I was 15 years old when I left Mississippi.
Do you think that Vicksburg is different from any other city down south, or do you think it's a little better or worse?
Well, Vicksburg is better than most cities in the south because all this trade come from tourists, and that's where the city get most of its money from. And they have to make the tourists feel good because a lot of the tourists come from northern cities, and they don't want to lose their business, so they be very nice and very liberal too, more than any other city in the south, in Mississippi at least.
How do the people feel about you in New York City and DCS?
Well, I really couldn't speak for all the people that in New York City, but I know the people said the school have treated me very nice and the teachers was very nice and the student, I think they are wonderful for myself.
How do you think this school is different from your school, or it's the same?
Well, the way I think the school is different from my school, it's much better teachers, and the standards are higher too, and the teachers take way more time with you, and I think it's much better than my school was.
Do you think that New York's Board of Education is better or worse than the Board of Education in Mississippi?
Well, I know the New York Board of Education is better than the board in Mississippi just because of the peoples here, the Negroes and the Puerto Ricans and other different races. But it's got a bad part to it too.
Well, do you think that New York accepts more different kinds of races like the Puerto Ricans and the Negroes more than any other of the southern states?
Well, I think they have to accept more races because most of a big majority of the people here are Puerto Ricans and Negroes, so it's not just New York, but it's the peoples are New York. I mean, the Puerto Ricans and the Negroes are New York, so they have to accept themselves.
Why were they prejudiced at you in Vicksburg?
Well, the reason why they were prejudiced, well, I couldn't tell you all the reason, but for one reason that they thought, some people in Vicksburg really thought that Negroes weren't equal to the human race, and they thought, they thought Negroes weren't equal to white. And they thought if the civil rights workers came down, they would get more Negroes to vote. And instead of them making all the laws in the city, the Negroes would be making the laws too.
What was your home like down in Vicksburg?
Well, I would have to get you to explain really what you want me to tell about.
Well, did you live by yourself in the house, you know, with your family? Or, you know, did you share with other people? How big was it?
Well, our house, right after the bombing, I mean, we moved to a four-room house on Bowman Street. And sometimes, most of the time, I wouldn't stay at home, though, because I would stay at the office most of the time, so I never did stay there too much.
What was your home life? What was the occupation of your family, of your parents?
Well, my mother never did work too much. She babysat at some time, and my father, he lives in Detroit, and he works at Ford Corporation.
Did you have any white friends?
Yes, I had about 15 white friends.
Well, did your Negro friends accept them?
Well, the kids in my community, all of us was real close together, and we had white friends too, and everybody accepted each other, but they never did. At the time, we never did talk about the civil rights movement or anything like that.
When you were young, how did you learn about the prejudicedness in the South?
Well, it's very easy to learn when you even go to a store and have to stand on a certain side to get grocery or something like that. So it's very easy to learn when you got signs, different signs for Negro and white.
Were your teachers Negroes or whites?
All Negro.
Did they let your parents vote down there?
Right, they did.
If you can vote down there, how come you don't have a Negro government?
Well, the reason why we don't have a Negro government is so many people, although you have got the right to vote in Vicksburg, so many people that are still afraid, and so many old people. And, if everybody did vote, it would be certain groups like NWA compromising with the Democratic Party of Mississippi like they did this summer. So that's what a plenty of them doing right now in Vicksburg. The middle class people just tying up the votes by doing that.
Did they make you vote for the certain man that they wanted? Like, did they force you to vote for Goldwater or anybody?
Well, no, they didn't. You could vote for anyone you wanted to.
What are your plans after you go to school in the North?
Well, my plans are to try to finish college somewhere, maybe at Tupelo, or just maybe any the best college I can get in. And I have been thinking about becoming a lawyer, but I want to just finish college and maybe get a degree in law or something like that and become a full-time civil rights worker.
What school did you go to when you came from down there?
Well, the school that I went to when I was there was a public school. The name of it was McIntyre.
Now we would like to thank our distinguished guest for being with us on Students Meet the Press. We have just brought you Students Meet the Press, and WDCS is signing off. Be sure to be here next week to hear another discussion with Students Meet the Press.
Same time, same place, same channel.
And therefore is the resource for the young. The dual status, socio-religious status, which old age and experience have claimed for the aged, is rewarded with honor and reverence by the young people. The transgression of this cultural aspect of African life is punished ruthlessly. To poke fun at old people is a mark of lack of education. The African mori of honoring the old and paying them respect in word, deed, and behavior, such as remaining standing and keeping quiet in their presence, continue unabated in the tradition-directed sectors of the 20th century African society. At an African gathering, a child sits on the floor or on the ground, as the case may be, at the feet of his father. He must walk behind and not abreast of his father or of an elder. He must stand up or at least sit properly on the ground on his approach. After meals, it is the boy's duty to remove the dishes. Young people are allowed to be present at a palaver, listen to, but not to participate in the deliberations, nor should they participate in the talk of their elders in the guest house. The observations made by Dr. Clooney Ziga of the upper Egyptian small town are true of the African societies south of the Sahara. He says, quote, "Veneration is deeply to us as it often seems tyrannically impressed upon children. In the presence of a father, it would be disrespectful to smoke, to sit, and to speak more than is necessary. If there are guests, the son does not eat with them, but serves. It is only by special desire of a guest that he joins the party. The younger brother has to behave in the same manner towards his elder." Unquote. Insulting an old person, whether male or female, is always severely sanctioned. Within the household or outside the elders, within the household or outside, the elders are always served first, are given the choice morsels of food, and are assigned the best seats at religious and social events. When traveling along the paths, it is the older person who is privileged to lead the way. No young person would contradict an elder, for the latter knows more and is therefore always right. All this indicates how influential and reverential old age articulates in African society. What is the place of the old in African culture? We have discussed at some length the influence of the aged in African society. We saw how the accumulated experiences of the aged through the years of his life have made him not only an outstanding figure in the society, but a resource person with whom consultation of matters relating to nature, for example, the seasons and the correct timing for farming, fishing, as well as matters relating to the gods and taboos are made. Unlike Western society, where the aged have their own homes and cared for by the state, in African societies, the aged lives with his posterity. There is a saying in the culture of the people of Ghana which goes thus: "Nia osha yiye ni nia owo pening," meaning, he who has an elderly person in his home is the one who acts properly. In other words, the place of the old person in African home is to give advice, instruct the young to exhibit good manners. Both the old men and old women, but especially the males, form a council of elders in each of the clans and extended families to advise on matters of familial policy, such as the proper choice of a marriage partner for young boy or girl in the clan, the division of wedding gifts following a marriage, or the appointment and use of other wealth which the family may receive or acquire, and the settling of disputes which may arise between families. The old people are the repositories of sacred and esoteric law respecting the clan and its unique techniques, for example, propitiation or methods of supplication for dealing with the supernatural. Such an ability to concur with spirits illustrates another source of the respect in which old people are held: fear or witchcraft and malevolent activities stemming from their displeasure. Although Western life is changing things fast in Ghana or Africa at large, it is still felt in tradition-directed sectors that old people have the power and therefore the inclination to exert harm on individuals who are unkind to them. In the past, infanticide was practiced by my tribe and, most commonly, was executed by an elderly person. In civic life, it is the elderly people who hold all the important offices. The young people learn by observation and by participation where the elderly person so requires the assistance of the young person. The old people spend their last years paying long visits to the house of each child or grandchildren. Unmarried or widowed or childless men and women are held in great and high esteem as any other elderly person. They serve in the capacity as lawmakers, judges, counselors, and priests where such an office has been established. Thank you.
That was the fourth in a series of programs on African culture.
And one who doesn't need him surely doesn't want to buy them. So much for that. Therefore, this is a problem involving one who needs glasses and has glasses. One who either took someone else's because he lost his own, or absentmindedly pushed his own up from his nose to his forehead and promptly forgot about him. For instance, me. Praise be the Lord. I am trained in our ancient manner of reasoning. Otherwise, I never would have found my glasses.
Several days before the Passover, a poor man came to the rabbi for advice.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Rabbi, I'm in desperate circumstances.
This is the mayor.
Passover is almost here, and I haven't the means with which to observe it properly.
Uh-huh.
I must get money for matzahs, for meat, and for sacramental wine. My family and I dare not show up in the synagogue for the holiday services. You see, we are all in tatters.
Don't worry, my son. God will help you.
The rabbi tried to soothe him, but the unhappy man would not be comforted.
I have too many worries, Rabbi. I'm afraid they're too much for me.
In that case, let's see what your needs are. How much do you need for matzahs, meat, and wine?
For matzahs, meat, and wine, I need 16 rubles.
16 rubles. Clothes for your children?
Clothes for the children, I need 18 rubles.
18 rubles. A dress for your wife?
I need 8 rubles.
8 rubles. A new suit for yourself?
10 rubles.
10 rubles. 18, 16. Well, altogether you need 52. Altogether you need 52 rubles. Now at least you won't have to worry about matzahs, meat, wine, and clothing. You only have one worry.
One worry? What's that, Rabbi?
Where to get the 52 rubles?
Where to get the 52 rubles?
Hugo.
The father took his little boy to the bath for the first time. When the little boy jumped into the pool, he began to shiver with cold and cry, "Oi, Papa, oi." His father then led him out of the pool, rubbed him down with a towel, and dressed him. "Ah, Papa, ah," said the little fella, tingling with a warm glow. Then the father said, "Isaac, do you know the difference between a cold bath and a sin?" "No," said the little boy. "No, Papa, what's the difference?" The father said, "I'll tell you. When you jump into a cold pool, you first yell, 'Oi!' And then you say, 'Ah!' But when you commit a sin, first you say, 'Ah!' And then you say, 'Oi!'"
Shopkeeper listened raptly to the rabbi's sermon on the Sabbath day in the synagogue. The rabbi preached,
"He who is poor in this life will be rich in the world to come. He who is rich here, by God's decree, will be poor in the next world. For all men are equally God's children, and he is just to them all."
Several days later, the shopkeeper went to see the rabbi.
"Rabbi,
yes? Do you really believe that those who are poor in this world will be rich in the next?
There's no doubt about it.
You know that I'm a poor shopkeeper. You mean to say that I'll be rich in the world to come?
Of course.
In that case, Rabbi, lend me 100 rubles. When I collect my riches in the next world, then I'll give you back the rubles.
Without a word, the rabbi counted out 100 shiny silver rubles. The poor merchant could not believe his own eyes. As he stretched out his hand to gather in the money, the rabbi stopped him and asked,
"What do you plan to do with your money, my son?"
"Well, I plan to buy some new merchandise."
"Do you expect to make money on it?"
"Make money? It will sell like Hanukkah pancakes."
"In that case, I can't give you the 100 rubles.
"Why not?"
"If you get rich here, you'll be poor over there. So how in the world do you expect to retain the loan?"
"Oh, yeah, thank you."
For a full hour, Mrs. Gutman from Suffolk Street handled every fan on the pushcart, feeling them, smelling them, weighing them, trying to decide which one to buy. "I'll take this penny fan," giving the disgusted peddler her coin. She then went home with her purchase. The following morning, bright and early, the peddler saw her standing big as life before him.
"What is it now?" he asked. Mutely, she held up the broken remnants of the fan she had purchased the day before.
"What's the matter?" he asked. "I want my money back," she said.
"But how much did you pay?"
"A penny," she said.
"And how did you use it?"
He said, "What kind of a foolish question is that?"
"Naturally, I waved it in front of my face from side to side."
"Is that what you do with a penny fan, Mrs. Gutman?" cried the peddler outraged.
"That's what you do with a 5 cent fan. With a penny fan, you hold the fan and you..."
Rabbi had prayed long and fervently. "And what have you prayed for today?" asked his wife. "My prayer is that the rich should give bigger alms to the poor," answered the rabbi. "Do you think he has heard your prayer?" his wife asked. "I'm sure he has heard at least half of it," replied the rabbi. "The poor have agreed to accept."
The old shaman began to lose his hearing. The doctor whom he consulted told him that too much alcohol was making him deaf.
"You mustn't drink anymore."
For one long month, the old shaman scrupulously avoided liquor and his hearing gradually returned. But suddenly he was tempted and he went back on the gargle again. This time he became deaf as a doorpost and he used a long ear horn. Once more he came to consult the doctor. "Didn't I tell you not to drink any more schnapps?" The old shaman shrugged his shoulders wearily. "Sure, you told me. And I did exactly as you told me. But believe me, doctor, nothing I heard was worth one good schnapps."
A Luftmensch, a dreamer, who didn't have a job and couldn't do anything, and he had come from Covenant to New York. And when he found out that the streets of America were not lined with gold, as being told in the old country, he then became a peddler of needles, pins, hooks, and eyes. Life was very hard, and insults were many, and the profits, of course, very small. So he kept his eyes open for some kind of a business. When he heard that a shamus was needed in a synagogue on Pike Street, he hurriedly went there to apply for the job. "Can you read and write English?" asked the president. "No," answered the peddler. "Sorry," said the president. "You see, in America, a shamus must be able to read and write. Especially here, you must read and write English." So the poor man sighed and he went away. In the course of time, he began to prosper. He turned to real estate and he made a fortune. One day, he needed $250,000 to finance a real estate venture. He went to his banker and asked for a loan and he immediately got it. The banker said to him, "Now here, read this loan and then sign it." He said, "But I'm sorry, I can't read or write. All I can do in all the years that I've been here is just to sign my name."
Oh, that's wonderful, said the president of the bank. You have accomplished so much. Imagine what you could have been if you were able to read and write. He said, sure, I would have been the shamus of the Pike Street Synagogue.
The snow is beautiful, but Mendel felt that each snowflake was a dagger thrust into his heart. Everything happens to me, he moaned. Just when I get my home fixed up, the landlord tells me the building is coming down. I gotta move. I slave and I slave, and at last I find a place around the corner. How shall I move? I struggle and struggle. I get everything arranged for moving tomorrow. And now it snows. And what a snow. Oh, he amazes me. It was a truly dark, dark night for Mendel. Shaking his head, he undressed wearily and he climbed into bed. But he couldn't get settled. Such trouble. What'll I do? He twisted and turned restlessly. What is there to do? He twisted and turned again. And this time, a thought struck him. I know. I'll borrow Goldberg's sled. It's simple. I'll pile the stuff on it, and one trip, two trips, three, four, five, 10 trips. It's done, wonderful, okay. Thank God. He turned and settled back comfortably. He was about to doze off again, and another thought struck him. What if Goldberg won't lend his sled? Nonsense, why shouldn't he lend his sled? Of course he will. Forget it. What if Goldberg won't lend his sled? Why not? What am I going to do with it? Can you imagine that? Goldberg not willing to lend me his sled? The scoundrel! A plague on him! What a nerve! Not to lend me the sled? It can't be! Of course he lent it to me. He turned around and settled himself for sleep. Goldberg won't lend his sled? Goldberg not lend his sled? It's unthinkable after what I did for him. Who got him his first job? Who showed him the ropes? Where did he get his meals when his wife was sick that time? I even introduced him to the galerie. And wasn't I his best man? Didn't I sign the paper for him for the Morris plan? And when he had the trouble that time, didn't I give him the money out of my own pocket, my hard-earned money? And now he won't lend me his lousy $2 sled? That's too much. I won't stand for it. Why? He scrambled out of bed. He pulled down his trousers, thrust his coat around his shoulders, dashed out in the street, ran to Goldberg's house, and started jabbing crazily at Goldberg's doorbell, muttering to him, the stinker, the lowlife, the no good. And finally, sleepy Goldberg came to the door. Goldberg, shouted Mendel. Goldberg, you no good, you ingrate, you lowlife. You know what you can do with your sled? You can take it and... Good night.
Hi. Molly Pecan.
Continue with Treasury of Jewish Folklore.
A rabbi of Chelm and one of the students spent the night at an inn. The student asked the servant to wake him at dawn because he had to make an early train. The servant did so. Not wishing to wake the rabbi, the student groped in the dark for his clothes, and in his haste, he put on the clothes of the rabbi. His shtreibel, that is the fur cap, the kaftan, the long gabardine coat, and hurried to the train. He boarded the train, entered his compartment, and as he looked into the compartment mirror, he was taken aback. What an idiot that servant is. I asked him to wake me. Instead, he woke the rabbi.
Two fools from Chelm became involved in a deep philosophical argument. Since you're wise, said one, try to answer this question. Why is it when a slice of buttered bread falls to the ground, it always falls on the buttered side?
But the other sage was a bit of a scientist, so he decided to disprove the theory with a practical experiment. He went and he buttered a slice of bread, and then he dropped it. There, you see? The bread, you see, has fallen, but it's not on the buttered side at all. So where is your theory now? Aha, said the other one. You think you're so smart. You buttered the wrong side of the bread.
The people that fell
were
in the act of the Kmaimaiseller.
Everybody gets into the act.
The people of Helm. The people of Helm were warriors. So they called a meeting to do something about the problem of worrying. A motion was duly made and seconded to the effect that Yosala, the cobbler, should be retained by the community as a whole to do all its worrying, and that his fee should be 1 ruble per week. The motion was about to carry. All speeches had been being made for the affirmative, when one chukham propounded the fatal question. If Yosala earned 1 ruble a week, what would he have to worry about?
Once on a visit to Berditchev, a sage of Helm joined a cycle of kibbutzers and the synagogue who were around the synagogue stove waiting for the services to begin. Seeing a stranger, the shamus thought he would entertain him. So he put to him the following riddle. Who is it? He's my father, yet he's not my brother. The sage of Helm racked his brains for quite a while, but in vain. Let me hear it again, he said. He's my father, not my brother. Ah, I give up, tell me. Who is it? Why, it's me, said the Berditchev shamus. The sage of Helm lost no time in hurrying back to Helm, and he gathered around him all the sages. My masters, he began, gravely stroking his long gray beard reflectively, I'm going to put a riddle to you and see if you can answer it. Now, listen carefully. Who is it? He's my father, yet he's not my brother. He's my father, he's not my brother. The sages cogitated and cogitated. They thought and they thought, and finally they said, we give up. Who is it? Who is it? It's the shamus of the Berditchev synagogue.
A man was married to a very difficult woman who ordered him around all day long. Once, when she had several of her lady friends in the house, she wanted to show that she had absolutely her husband in absolute control. So she said to him, Shlemiel, get under the table. And with that, her husband crawled under the table. A moment later, she said, now, Shlemiel, come out from under the table. He looked from under the table and he said, I won't. I'll show you who's master in my house.
Once there was a Jew who had a wife and 6 children, but no source of income. His wife scolded them all day long for being a schlemazel, and his children cried all the time because they were hungry. And so with a troubled spirit, he sat down to think. Suddenly a terrible thought occurred to him. He was going to become a highwayman, a bandit, a wicked, throat-slitting highwayman. You had often heard tales of such men, how with the greatest of these they acquired huge sums of money. Not that he had ever seen any, but he was not going to stand his wife snagging anymore. He would show her what kind of schlemazel he was. So early one morning, he put on a large sack over his clothes, stuck a hatchet into his belt, took along his talus and film, and he went into the forest. He hid behind a tree,
from there kept a sharp look, a sharp lookout. He waited and waited. But what poor Jew has luck? The morning passed, the afternoon passed, and still not a solitary person came in sight. Finally, the sun began to set, and the shadows of night fell. Seeing this, the bandit became uneasy. Lurie said, "What can I do now? It's time for Mincha prayer." So he started to pray. But no sooner had he started the 18 benedictions than he was reciting, "Look but upon our affliction, and our fight, and redeem us speedily for the sake of thy name." And he suddenly saw a Jew coming towards him. Silently, he motioned him to wait until he had finished the prayer. Politely and with a pious man's regard for another man's devotion, the stranger waited. Having finished the recitation of the 18th benediction with a resounding
Umay.
The highwayman ran up to the stranger and drawing his hatchet, he cried, "Your money or your life?"
"What are you, crazy or something?"
"I'm a bandit. And if you won't give me all of your money right away, I'm going to kill you in cold blood."
"I'm a Jew, a poor man, a father and a husband. How do you expect a man like me to have money? Surely you don't want to make my children orphans and my wife a widow? If you kill me, who will provide for them? You don't want them to die of hunger?"
"Never. A poor man, a father, a husband. You're right. It would be indeed a pity to kill you. Oh, very well then. I won't kill you. But give me a ruble."
"A ruble? Who do you take me for? Rothschild?"
"Give me 10 kopecks.
10 kopecks? Where would I get 10 kopecks from? Even the rich man doesn't give 10 kopecks at one smack."
"In that case, give me a cigarette."
"A cigarette? What am I looking for? I don't smoke."
"No. Let me have at least a pinch of snuff."
"Why didn't you say so in the first place? A pinch of snuff? Come here. Come over. Here. Isn't tight.
To America from a little Russian town. He didn't know how to read and he didn't know how to write, but he opened a clothing store in New York and he began to prosper. In time, he went to the bank to open up a checking account. Not knowing how to write his name, he made 2 crosses. As time went on, he prospered. He sold the cloak and suit business and then began to manufacture silks. So he went to the bank and he opened up a new account. This time he signed all the bank documents with 3 crosses. "Why 3 crosses, the president asked. "You always used to sign with 2 crosses. He says, "Well, you know how women are, fancy, schmancy. My wife wanted me to take on a middle name."
"Well, and fine, met on the street. Shalom Aleichem.
Go to hell."
"What is this? I greet you nicely, and I say to you, Shalom Aleichem, and you answer me so rudely. What's the idea?"
"I'll tell you. If I were to speak to you politely, you would ask me what I'm doing. And I would say I'm going to the 8th Street bath. So you would say I'm crazy. The Avenue A baths are better. And I would say you're crazy. The 8th Street baths are better. And one voice would lead to another, and you would call me a damn fool, and I would say, go to hell. So why waste time? I say, go to hell and finish."
"Well, the
Sholem Aleichem, Shmuel Rabinowitz, the celebrated Yiddish writer, was once seen by a friend talking to himself on the street.
For heaven's sake, cried the friend, do you realize you're talking to yourself?
And what if I do, said Sholem Aleichem? When at last I found a clever person to talk to, you'll have to stick in your 2 cents.
Ladies.
Do you know the accused?
How should I know?
Did he ever borrow money from you?
Why should he borrow money from me?
Did the accused ever lend you money?
Why should he lend me money?
Why do you answer every question with a question?
Why not?
A mother tenderly guided her 4-year-old Sue Ella down 2nd Avenue. As they crossed 14th Street, Sue Ella sneezed. God bless you, my sweet, breathed mama, patting the child's head. As they crossed 13th Street, the child again, and may your health be a thing of wonder, my jewel, mama sweetly sighed. At 12th Street, the child again. Yeah. Once more, Mama patted her head and uttered a fervent Gesundheit, mein Kind. At 11th Street, little Sarah sneezed again. She received a smack in the face. To the devil with you, cried Mama. You're catching another cold.
Although he himself had been deprived of the opportunity of an education, the wealthy Mr. Goldberg sent his only daughter to a finishing school in Paris. Upon her return to this country, she was married, and in due course of time, she was taken to a maternity hospital. When the family obstetrician came to find out how she was doing, she moaned languorously, mon Dieu! Mon Dieu! The father was alarmed. Quick, doctor, she's given birth. Shh. Take your time. It isn't time yet. An hour later, she heard the doctor coming, and again she began.
Sauvez-moi, doctor! Sauvez-moi, doctor! Monsieur le docteur! Je vous en prie! Vite, vite!
The father was beside himself. Quick, go in, she's giving birth. Take it easy. It ain't time yet. A few minutes later, some piercing cries rang through the hospital corridors.
Oi! Oi, come out! Mama knew! Lots of it, Mama knew!
Now is time, said the doctor. And he went in and delivered the baby.
A little Jew was sitting in a train with a valise in the aisle, and a conductor walked by and said to the little Jew, is that your valise in the aisle? And the little Jew said, la dee la 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 la. The conductor says, if that's your valise, please put it underneath your chair because people will trip on it. And the little Jew said, the conductor says, if you don't put your valise underneath your chair, I'm going to pick it up and fling it out of the window. The little Jew said, the conductor picked up the valise, flung it out of the window, and the little Jew said, it's not my valise. Congratulations, Mazel Tov, Captain.
Thank you.
So you won the lottery?
Yes, I won.
49.
How did you do it?
I'll tell you how I did it. It happened in a dream. I saw it in a dream. 6 sevens were dancing in the dream. You know the numbers? 6 sevens, so 6 times 7 is 49.
6 times 7 is 42.
42. Fellas, you be the mathematicians.
There you go.